In the coming week, it's the 10th anniversary of the start of Syria's civil war. Leaders from the US, Japan, India, and Australia meet in the first ever Quad Summit, and the UK releases a post-Brexit review on defense and foreign policy. It's March 11, 2021, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay. Bob, the coming week marks a grim anniversary in Syria. It will be 10 years since the start of the Syrian civil war. More than 400,000 Syrians have died in the fighting, which failed to oust the government of Bashar al-Assad. The Assad government has regained control of much of the country, but the economy is in tatters and food insecurity is deepening. Can you give us an update on the situation in Syria as the country marks this somber anniversary?
Sure, Jim. So just to finish out some of the numbers that you started with, in addition to all those deaths, we have about half the population displaced, including about 5 million refugees. You have a fresh report from UNICEF saying there's more than 10,000 of the dead are children. The causes of death are a somber litany, including chemical weapons. There's repeated reports, extensive reports of torture. War crimes have been reported by a number of international organizations that watch for these things. And as you say, there is it's a country in which the government of Bashar al-Assad controls a lot of the territory, but there are still some pockets that it has no control over. And that includes a northwest enclave where about 3 million people, most of them displaced, live, and that Turkey sort of nominally holds sway. You have a pretty large swath of central and eastern Syria that Syrian Kurds are a dominant force. There are still some elements of ISIS, the so-called Islamic State, that are fighting against various forces. And there continues to be proxy battles going on, forces either directly of other nations or their proxies. So Iranian-affiliated forces, either it's Hezbollah or Shia militias from Iraq. You have certainly Russian forces entrenched there. As I said, Turkish forces. There are still a number of U.S. forces numbering by some accounts up to 1,000 in the east to northeast. Some of them are keeping watch over oil installations and so forth, but they're also nominally there to counter any sort of ISIS resurgence. And there's this sense that the peace process, which actually exists, a UN-led peace process, is going nowhere. And so we mark 10 years with one of the bleakest situations any country is facing, any sort of populace is facing, and really uncertainty over where Syria is going to be going and what is the end game for this place.
Bob, can you walk us through what the Biden administration's policy is towards Syria against the backdrop of what had been a U.S. policy of at least hoping for the ouster of the Assad government? That clearly is not going to happen. We still have some troops, as you mentioned, in eastern and northeastern Syria performing a variety of missions. Is the Biden administration looking to leave Syria? Is it looking to create a new relationship with the Assad government? Is policy just sort of on autopilot and continuing? What is the Biden administration doing?
I would say none of those things that you staked out, but still very much in formulation. Let's note that the very first military action of the Biden administration was to go after Iran-backed forces in Syria that were seen as responsible for targeting U.S. base in northern Iraq, in the Kurdish region of Iraq. So already there's a military action there. You have in the National Security Council, the former Obama administration anti-ISIS czar, Brett McGurk, building a team or rebuilding a team of many veterans of that campaign, sort of reconstituting that effort. So I think they still see the need to formally and completely expunge ISIS from the region. And then I think more broadly, the formulation part, Jim, seems to be that they do, you know, want to help oversee some sort of resolution to the Syrian process, but there's certainly no sort of vigorous U.S. role in diplomacy that we can see as of yet. I think as the administration continues to build its team to get various high-level officials confirmed, that might take shape further. It was marked by a little bit of chaos and continuity in the last couple of years of the Trump administration, where you had, first of all, the number of U.S. forces in Syria drawing down sharply after a tweet from President Trump, and which had followed, I believe, a conversation he had with the Turkish President Erdogan. A bit of chaos involving the Syrian Kurd allies of the U.S., who the Turks see as directly related to their own separatist Kurdish insurrection in their country. And so that is an issue that's going to continue to have to play out between the U.S. and Turkey. But then there's also broadly, you know, the U.S. forces, will they come into proximity or will they coordinate with, say, Russian forces that are not only backing up Assad, but are supposed to be, in some cases, countering ISIS forces that are running up against the Syrian regime. So a real mess, and a real, also a humanitarian, as we started out this this discussion, Jim, a real humanitarian nightmare that I think should be a starting point, as well as ultimately diplomacy.
I should note on that score, Bob, there had been a U.S. special envoy to Syria handling the Syria issue. The Biden administration has not named, as I understand it, a Syria envoy. Indeed, it's not even clear that the Biden administration is going to keep that office at all. And of course, this takes us back to a bigger issue we've talked about a lot over the last several months since the November election, which is the difficult time the Biden administration is having staffing up. Again, this is true of all administrations. It's particularly acute in case of the Biden administration because of the late start, the slow pace of Senate confirmation of various positions across the administration. We still haven't confirmed all of the nominees for the cabinet. And again, we spent a lot of time talking about who's going to be secretary for various executive agencies, but there are lots of rungs below that that need to be filled in. And so, of course, the world doesn't sit around waiting for the United States to fill in all the slots on the organizational flowchart. Things go on. But again, this is a challenge this administration faces, all administrations face, but I think particularly acute with the Biden administration and the relatively slow staffing up.
Yeah, absolutely, Jim. And that's, you know, in addition to all the other things that the administration is trying to balance out in terms of its policy priorities, and some of which we'll be getting to in a moment. But you're right that the personnel issue is one that is a bit hard to read and play out right now. But certainly, I don't think you're going to see anything majorly ambitious happening on this front. As I say, a bit of status quo in a region where status quo is a little bit less than awful, but still, it's a terrible situation there.
And I think, obviously, once you get fully staffed up, then you can decide what it is that you want to do. I think the overarching desire of the administration is to be less involved in the Middle East rather than more involved in the Middle East. But as you know, the United States is not the only player who has a say in what happens in the region. I think we'll get to a little bit more of that later in the podcast.
That is right. So why don't we turn our attention, Jim, a little bit further east to Asia, the Asia Pacific Rim, to be specific. And we are coming up on the first ever Quad Summit happening in the coming week. This is a virtual summit that brings together the leaders of the United States, Japan, India, and Australia. Now, this is happening just a few days before Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin and Secretary of State Antony Blinken travel in person to Japan and South Korea. And they will have high-level in-person meetings with Japanese, South Korean, and then eventually Chinese officials as well. Jim, can you tell us first a little bit about the history of the quadrilateral security dialogue?
Sure, Bob, but let's sort of put everything in a broader perspective, which is that Joe Biden campaigned by saying that rebuilding relations with traditional partners and allies and countering China topped his list of foreign policy priorities. And I think that's what you're seeing in action here. Now, what the Biden administration is trying to do is to breathe life into this Quad idea. And the four countries are the United States, Australia, India, and Japan. The history of the Quad actually goes back to 2007, and it was created to try to coordinate policy among all four countries. But as you point out, tomorrow's virtual summit will be the first ever leader-level Quad meeting. You're going to have Australia's Prime Minister Scott Morrison, India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi, and Japan's Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga on the call or on this virtual Zoom meeting. It's coming against the backdrop of a virtual Quad meeting that was held last month among the foreign ministers. And among the things they did was to condemn the coup in Myanmar and call for a return of democracy. I think it's interesting if you look at how the other members of the Quad have described this virtual meeting, you get a sense of what the overarching goals are. And I'll note that Prime Minister Modi's office said the topics of discussion are, let me quote them here, regional and global issues of shared interest and to exchange views on practical areas of cooperation toward maintaining a free, open, and inclusive Indo-Pacific region, close quote. I think you can read that primarily as being about China. And I am certain that is how the meeting is being read in Beijing. Now, we expect there's going to be a fair amount of discussion of how to respond to COVID-19, economic cooperation, and the climate crisis. There's a good chance that there will be agreements announced that Australia, Japan, and the United States will work to help India increase its manufacture of COVID-19 vaccines. India actually is a leading country in the world in terms of overall vaccine production, and India certainly has been pressing other countries to help it to increase its vaccine production and to do so in good part to counter China's efforts. One topic I I don't think the leaders are going to be talking about are rising concerns about India's democratic backsliding. This, of course, gets you into the tough part of the Biden foreign policy wish list, which is that it wants to promote democracy around the world and reverse backsliding. But some of the countries it most wants to work with are actually regressing on that score. And as you mentioned, this leaders' meeting is going to be followed up by the Austin Blinken visit to Japan and South Korea. When those meetings end, Secretary of State Blinken will meet with Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, and leading Chinese foreign policy officials for meeting in Anchorage, while Secretary of Defense Austin will depart the region and go to India for meetings in New Delhi with his counterparts.
So, Jim, it strikes me that, and I've seen a number of pieces of analysis on this, that the Quad is still sort of a nice idea in search of concrete actions and activities. And in looking at the way this region sort of favors summits and multilateral gatherings and pronouncements and so forth, it reminds me a little of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization that China set up and catalyzed after the U.S., you know, moved massively into Afghanistan and sort of wanted to sort of counter that. This seems like it's a little bit of a counter to the China Belt and Road Initiative, among other things. But I know it's more complicated than that. So could you talk a little bit about what we should look for after this summit in terms of, you know, meaningful steps or maybe just gestures by the group?
Well, that's a great question, Bob. And I think what people should be paying attention to is not just what is done in the Quad Forum, but what kinds of cooperation do we get with these countries and others in other fora? And by that, I mean bilateral as well as regional. Again, you know, the relations the United States has with each of these countries varies. Japan and Australia are treaty allies. India is not, but obviously they operate in a variety of different international fora. And there are obviously other countries involved. And I think one of the things to pay attention to on the eve of the visit by the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Defense to South Korea and Japan is that just this week, the United States wrapped up what had been rather contentious discussions about host country support in South Korea for the U.S. military presence there. You may recall that President Trump, when he was in office, made a big deal about allies essentially fleecing the United States, and he had pushed for the South Koreans to spend a lot more money supporting U.S. troops. Indeed, he even went so far as to halt U.S. military exercises in collaboration with the South Korean military and asked the South Koreans to quintuple the support they provided for the roughly 30,000 American troops on the peninsula. The Biden administration reached a deal with the South Korean government, which will increase South Korean host country support by roughly 14% in the coming year, and there'll be subsequent increases after that. And again, this gets us back to the fundamental foreign policy intuition of the Biden administration, which is let's find ways to improve, reinvigorate our cooperation with our allies, because that is our key. That's our main advantage in trying to counter what we see as gravely concerning actions coming out of Beijing. And again, the argument is that if you want China to be less aggressive, or if you want China to be more cooperative, the way you do that is by showing the Chinese that you can compete and you can compete effectively by marshaling other countries. That's the intuition. And I think that's what they're trying to do. And it's, again, interesting that the meeting of the SecDef and the SecState in Tokyo and Seoul is going to be followed by this meeting with the National Security Advisor and the Secretary of State with essentially their counterparts in Anchorage, Alaska, with the Chinese. And I think, again, what the Biden administration is trying to communicate to Beijing is we want to cooperate with you where we can, but we will compete with you where we need to. And our hope is that we can broaden the array of things that we cooperate on and shrink the number of things that we compete on. I think that's the overarching idea.
And the former, Jim, it seems like, although there has been some competition, obviously, and some hard feelings, it does seem like there is room to cooperate on coronavirus vaccine distribution, for example, and maybe climate change issues as well, as had been in the past. Is that right?
Certainly there are, Bob. I mean, it's easy to lay out where you can cooperate. The question is there a will to cooperate because those issues exist alongside of issues where you're at loggerheads. And again, the Chinese don't like seeing what appears to be a formation of an anti-China coalition. Their strategy has been to divide and conquer. They're going to continue to do that. Beyond that, you have the Chinese looking out. Their actions in many areas have alarmed the Biden administration. And again, this meeting in Anchorage is going to take place against the backdrop of news that Chinese state actors have conducted a massive hack of U.S. companies and organizations. And the question raised for the Biden administration is, shouldn't you retaliate in some way to make the Chinese pay a price for this? And of course, if you retaliate, whether it's with sanctions or you do some kind of secret cyber pushback, that raises tensions. It may conflict with your efforts to build cooperation. And this is sort of the difficult dance of diplomacy. To what extent do you want to push to basically get the other side to back down versus not wanting to push and have that push be seen as a provocation to make things worse? And it's very hard in the abstract to sort of lay out how much pushing is productive versus how much pushing and where the pushing becomes counterproductive. And again, there's a lot of issues in which the United States and China are at loggerheads. Think about Chinese behavior in the South China Sea, China's treatment of the Uyghurs, China's treatment of Tibet, China's aggression against India in the Himalayas. I mean, we can go down the laundry list of issues where the two sides are
Hong Kong and so forth.
There are lots of issues. And again, the challenge of diplomacy is to try to figure out a way to make all of those net out. And it's very easy to talk about what the United States wants to do, but the United States is not in a dance by itself. The Chinese get a say in how this is all going to go. And the signs thus far have been that the Chinese think that they are winning. We talked about this last week with the start of the two legislative sessions, that time and momentum are on their side and they're going to win. And you get into the notion, if you were winning, why should you start behaving as if you're in fact losing? So it's going to be a real test of American diplomacy. And again, I would say it's not just what the United States does overseas, but it's also going to be what the United States does at home. And that's why the COVID relief package, whether the United States can put together an infrastructure package, whether we can up our investment in basic research and development, and in some ways recapture the magic of American innovation, recapture the reputation for being a country that is both competent and reliable, will become pivotal in this, what I think is going to be a long-term contest between Washington and Beijing. Bob, as the Biden administration charts its course in East Asia, it's not the only country doing so. Indeed, in the coming week, the government of the United Kingdom is set to release a post-Brexit review of its defense and foreign policy. The report is expected to call for Britain to strengthen its military and diplomatic position in Asia, in part to counter the growing power of China. This publication is expected to be followed by a defense-specific document that will lay out plans for the British military going forward. Can you tell us a little bit more about what we can expect from London in the coming week, Bob?
Sure, Jim. And there is a through line, I think, from what we were just talking about with Asia in terms of how officials in London are viewing the world, according to accounts we've seen so far. Because like a lot of major reports, there has been leaking going on. And so we're seeing in publications like the Financial Times and the Guardian some excerpts of what this report could say. The big takeaway is this is setting out what's being referred to as the global Britain policy. And this is post-Brexit, how Britain views its place in the world. It's also being viewed as one of the biggest reviews of British foreign policy since the end of the Cold War. So taking stock of where it stands, not only in relation to its neighborhood, but more broadly, the Asia aspect has gotten a lot of attention. Some of the leaked aspects of the document say it calls for an investment in, quote, China-facing capabilities, end quote, to be able to respond better to challenges that China poses. And that includes, by the way, cybersecurity, where the UK is particularly strong and innovative, but also talking about the Indo-Pacific region, not necessarily a play to be part of the Quad, which would be a quint or whatever, but certainly to be a presence there and to bolster relations with India. There's supposed to be more details coming out about the deployment of a new aircraft carrier, the Queen Elizabeth aircraft carrier, which is due to be setting sail for the Pacific and could be even deployed in the South China Sea, Jim. So it's very much Britain kind of asserting its new place in the world or the starting sort of framework of what that could be. Also, how it's reconciled with the country's budgeting towards defense, its core commitments as well to structures like NATO, very much a part of NATO. It's part of the quote unquote E3 relationship with the UK that involves the UK, France, and Germany on creating a policy toward Iran within the EU. So the UK plays an important role. It's still one of the, obviously, the permanent five members of the UN Security Council, which has veto power. It will be interesting to see how much it coordinates with EU and UN Security Council affairs. It used to be much tighter, although there were areas where it diverged. But now, you know, post-Brexit, how much will the UK and, say, France confer on important matters in the UN Security Council? So all of these things, but I think this maybe not a pivot, but certainly a move towards more focus on Asia is generating a lot of interest for what it actually means and what it means for Britain's longstanding role in the North Atlantic, where it's also supposed to be a very important partner. It traditionally has had a very strong, potent military. The U.S. has relied on it repeatedly. It was one of the few major Western states to back the U.S. effort in Iraq to oust Saddam Hussein. It has been a vigorous part of the Afghanistan mission. And so what does this mean for that alliance, as well as Britain's role more broadly?
I'm interested in reading the reports when they come out, Bob, to see how they justify or frame the need for Britain to make China a focus of its defense and foreign policy. I certainly understand the argument for beefing up Britain's cyber capabilities to ward off intrusions from the Chinese, because obviously cyberspace, geographical distance disappears. And it's very clear that the Chinese have been probing everyone's networks, potentially stealing information or worse, planting booby traps that could be activated in the future. But it's a different question about thinking in terms of China, in terms of the physical defense forces, again, because Asia is a very long way away. And the question is, for Britain, what kind of capabilities can it bring to issues in Asia, given its size? This is no longer the Britain that strode the world and had an empire on which the sun never set. The Royal Navy is much smaller than it used to be. Depending upon how you count the size of the Navy, it has somewhere between 30 and 70 ships. If you take the general rule of thumb that at any time, one third of ships are at home, one third of ships are on patrol, and one third of ships are either going to or coming back from patrol, it's not really clear, given other issues that the British Navy has to worry about, that it brings meaningful capabilities to East Asia or to South Asia. So very interesting to see how that goes. And then, of course, there's going to be the question of the reaction of the British public. Are they willing to make an investment in a larger navy or to make China a particular focus of defense and foreign policy planning? One of the arguments that has often been made about Brexit is it came about because there was some longing on the part of Britons, particularly older Britons, to return to some gloried and storied past. And it's not at all clear that in the current circumstances that Britain is capable of taking on that role.
It's a really good point, Jim. Maybe the most cogent point of focus at this point. It does seem like in the signaling towards sort of building and enhancing ties with India, but also Australia and South Korea even, that Britain wants to be part of maybe a coalition, maybe organized under the U.S. The Washington reaction is going to be very interesting to this report as well. And that Britain will sort of be on the sort of the right side of history, shall we say, as China mounts its ongoing, you know, moves through the Belt and Road Initiative, through, you know, asserting itself in the South China Sea and so forth. And so, you know, you've seen Britain, for example, throw open its borders to Hong Kong residents, really accepting very large numbers of residents of Hong Kong to move to the UK, for example. It staked out a different position, and this really picked up steam last year, from continental European countries towards China in terms of things like 5G and trade with China in general. There's a real wariness, certainly on the side of Conservative Party Brits, towards China. And does this reflect, though, as you say, Jim, does this reflect the public skepticism and even concern among Brits towards China's role in the world, China's assertiveness? So that's going to be interesting to see how much traction they can get from this as this comes out. It's supposed to be something like a 100-page document. It's going to be parsed over a lot. But this role vis-a-vis China, far away from Britain, is going to be, I think, one of the more interesting ones and maybe one of the more areas that'll require some more details.
Bob, just two quick points in this. first, my guess is the Biden administration likes what it's hearing about what the report is going to say, because clearly what the Biden team is arguing for is we're going to rally all of our traditional friends and allies to counter China, to try to persuade China to work with us rather than against us. And so that's music to Washington's ears. The second point, though, is, again, to what extent Britain in a post-Brexit world is going to want to make that investment, because one of the arguments for leaving the EU was to free up Britain so it could engage in all kinds of economic activity. Well, China is clearly a dominant economy, and that means that Britain, because it has economic relations with China, could find itself being pressured by Beijing, and it won't have the ability, as it would have had in the EU, to sort of have automatic protection because it was part of a much larger bloc. And so there is this question of whether this new foreign defense policy can coexist easily with this notion of a Britain going out building lots of economic ties around the world, something to keep an eye on.
Yeah, and I would say also keep an eye on any reference to the Commonwealth countries. There's been talk about in the aftermath of Brexit, the UK building up economic ties. So going beyond this, a ceremonial relationship with some of the Commonwealth countries it has and actually putting some teeth into them, some trade teeth, that will be interesting as well. But your point's well taken, Jim. And that's, I think, this new world for the UK, how, you know, incongruous will it be from in the post-Brexit period? Jim, it's time for us to do our own pivot and discuss our audience figure of the week, which listeners can vote on or tweet us at CFR_org. This week, Jim, our audience selected B-52s Over the Mideast. I'm guessing it's not the music group, Jim, so can you tell me a little bit why this is significant?
Bob, you're right. It's not about the punk rock band, but rather about B-52 bombers that flew over the Middle East on Sunday. The planes, which took off from Minot Air Base in North Dakota, flew to the Middle East. When they got to the region, they were accompanied by aircraft from Israel, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar. This was the fourth such deployment of the B-52s to the Middle East this year, second time under President Joe Biden. And the purpose of the flight was to send a signal to Iran. And it comes amidst rising tensions between Washington and Tehran. And as the official U.S. statement put it, the flight was to, let me quote them here, deter aggression and reassure partners and allies of the U.S. military's commitment to security in the region. And again, this is part of the jockeying going back and forth between Tehran and Washington. Obviously, at the heart of it is the issue of what is going to happen with Iran's nuclear program. Is it going to come back into compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal? Is the United States going to rejoin the nuclear deal as the Biden administration hopes to? But it's not just about nuclear issues. It's also about Iran's broader behavior in the region. As you know, recently, President Biden ordered military strikes against Iranian allied groups in Syria after missile attacks on bases in northern Iraq that hosted U.S. troops. So this is just another chapter in this long-running contest between the United States and Iran.
Yeah, I think it's significant. It's a significant, I won't say sideshow, but very much important sort of side set of issues as the countries kind of do this wary diplomatic dance around a return to the table on the Iran nuclear deal. The Biden administration has clearly indicated it is aware of Iran's other activities and that while they are very interested in getting back to the table on the nuclear deal, it doesn't mean that they are ignoring others. We should also note the first set of U.S. sanctions by the Biden administration on Iran went into effect this week, targeting some Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps officials.
And I should note, in ordering the flight, the Biden administration is trying to send a clear signal of resolve to the Iranian government. But as we know, the messages you think you are sending aren't necessarily the messages that are being received. And what we don't know is how the leadership in Iran views the flights. Do they view it as a sense that Biden really is committed and is willing to use military force if pushed? Or do they view it as simply symbolic and actually a sign of weakness because they doubt that the Biden administration or President Biden is willing at the end of the day to escalate military tensions? And again, the Iranian argument would be the United States has signaled for the last decade under President Obama, under President Trump, and under President Biden that they want to reduce their involvement in the region, not increase it. And if the Iranian leadership is convinced of that, they are likely to dismiss these kind of actions as simply being symbolic. Now, of course, the real danger is if one country is committed to a course of action and another country doesn't believe it's committed to a course of action, that's when you have misperceptions that collide and can produce conflict.
And so we end our discussion where we began, in the Middle East. And that's our look at the world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. The prime ministers of the Baltic states meet via video conference, and the Netherlands holds a general election.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program is produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe also did double duty as a recording engineer. Thank you very much, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Anna Shortridge and Bethany Wright for their assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and stay healthy out there.